Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Yes, good evening to you. How are you on this Tuesday, the 7th of February? I'm Philip Clark and welcome to Nightlife. Plenty to talk about tonight. We're looking at whether it's time to get into the stock market or some other form of investment. I wonder what you are thinking about all of that. Well, to guide your thinking tonight, Roger Montgomery is going to be here with us and we'll be discussing just exactly where markets went over the last year. This is despite all the predictions of where they would go. Then we'll look at what Roger's view of where things might end up in 2017. Always a source of opinion and advice, Roger is. So make sure you have that number handy, 1-300-800-222. If you'd like to ask a question about any aspect of investment tonight, 1-300-800-222. Our text line 0467-922-702. After that, we'll head down to Antarctica. We're going to have a look at what the latest is there with Dr. Merin McKinnon, who joined a whole group of leading female scientists who converged on Antarctica. And she'll report on the latest, and she'll also shed some light on the curious story of the pom-pom crab. Hollywood Hot Goss with Catherine Tulich, and our issue of the day, what do you think of Russia? And what do you make of President Putin? Is he someone we should be working with or against?
He's a killer, though. Putin's a killer.
A lot of killers. You got a lot of killers. Why, you think our country's so innocent?
Yes, President Trump replying to Fox News presenter Bill O'Reilly about what he thinks of President Putin. I wonder what you think about all of that. There's a bit of revisionist thinking going on, isn't there, about attitudes towards Russia. Are they warranted? And what should Australia's position be? We'll do all of that, plus, of course, the mighty challenge, 25 questions, and question 25 is the number to answer to win. So we'll look at all of that too. Hope you can join us and share in the conversation. You're on Nightlife with me, Philip Clark. 1-300-800-222 is our telephone number.
This is Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
On a Tuesday evening across the country too, Roger Montgomery, Chief Investment Officer of Montgomery Investment Management, joins us regularly to talk about investment markets. And I'm pleased to say he's back here in the studio with us this evening. Your chance to ask anything you like, 1-300-800-222. Line's free if you want to grab one. Roger, good evening.
Good evening, Phil. It's nice to be back.
Well, welcome to 2017.
Thank you very much.
Yes. The start of every year, of course, everyone's, I'm sure, or full of expectations about what might happen. We could look back at 2016 and see what did happen.
Well, it's probably best to summarise two major asset classes that I think occupy most people's minds, and one is shares and the other one's property.
Yep.
On the share market, we had a really interesting turn of events over the course of the year, and it even surprised me, the extent of it. What we saw was a bounce in commodity prices like iron ore. And so as a result, companies like BHP and Rio and Fortescue Metals saw significant rallies in their share prices. And this was partly due to the fact that large institutions, and I have some stats with me today, and it's public information, so I'm happy to read it out. But companies like the big fund managers, not little boutiques like us, but for the Fidelities and Ausbils and BTs and Macquaries of the world, they did this little thing called rotating, which means that they moved out of one particular type of asset class or one particular type of stock or share on the stock market and moved into another type. And what they did was they rotated out of the smaller to mid-capitalized high growth companies, which they sold off very aggressively in order to fund the purchase of resource companies like BHP and Fortescue and Rio.
Why?
Well, they had a belief that the future under potential Trump presidency was going to be inflationary. They believe that demand for China would increase because of infrastructure spending and reflation there. And at some point, that will happen, but I think it's way too soon because the other side of the equation is the supply equation. And you might remember it wasn't that many years ago that iron ore was sitting at $180 a ton. And what happened, of course, was there was a very big supply response from Australia. And as a result of that supply response, and including South America, the iron ore price collapsed. Mm. And it took time, of course, to collapse because it took time to develop the mines, the additional mines, because all the companies obviously want to take advantage of the higher prices. So they develop these mines. They take 5 to 7 years to construct and develop. And that happened, and the price collapsed. And now the price is bouncing again, because what happened was some of these mines were mothballed, or they were put on hold. The iron ore price bounced, and what do you think is going to happen to supply when the iron ore price goes up? It's going to come on again.
Mines will come back on stream.
And it won't take 7 years this time because they're already been developed. So it's unlikely that the rally will last, but what actually happened was that companies like BHP saw their share price rise about 58%. Rio Tinto rose about 52% for the year, and Fortescue Metals Group shares went up by about 248% for the year. Mm. And that drove the materials index, so the stock market index that tracks all of these types of companies, drove it up by about 72 or 73% for the year. And that meant fund managers like me, who don't own any of these companies and probably won't, we did relatively poorly because we didn't have these things that were going up. Now, you might think that doesn't sound very bright or very intelligent if you've missed out on these things going up, but we're not in the business of betting on black or red. You know, we're looking at good businesses. And if I describe the business of BHP to you in a certain way, you'll scratch your head wondering why anyone owns shares in it. So keep in mind that it rose by, what was it, about 58% for the year. But let me give you this opportunity to invest in a business, Phil. So I want you to imagine that you're going to invest $1.4 billion of your own money over the next 10 years. Okay, so currently the business that you own is earning about $16 billion profit. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to ask you over the next 10 years to put in an additional $1.4 billion of your own money. So you literally write checks to $1.4 billion. Now, over the next 10 years, the company is going to earn profits, but instead of paying them to you as dividends, $34 billion of that money is going to be reinvested in the business. So rather than you receiving it, you're going to plow it back into the business. Mm-hmm. So on top of the $1.4 billion that you wrote checks for, you're going to put another $34 billion odd in there. And we're going to go down to the bank and we're going to increase the borrowings by about $34 billion as well, up from over the top of the $16 billion you've already borrowed. So if you think about this, if you think about the fact that you've put in $1.4 billion, you've reinvested from the cash flow of the company another $34.5 billion that you could have taken out, but you didn't, you put that money in, and you borrowed an extra $34 billion. If you gave me that $70 billion, I could stick it in the bank, mm-hmm. and I would earn more interest in 10 years' time than I'm earning today, just because I've got more money.
That's right.
What did BHP do with that extra money? Remembering that it was earning $16 billion 10 years ago, mm-hmm. with the benefit of that additional $70 billion of capital, in 2016, 10 years later, it only earned $1.9 billion. So it earned almost 90% less than what it was earning 10 years earlier.
How can that be?
Well, because it reinvested in things that haven't paid off.
Okay.
Or they would argue haven't paid off yet, and maybe they
still
will.
That's what these businesses have to do.
That's it. I'd rather own a business that doesn't have to do that. Yeah. And there are businesses out there that you don't need to put a single extra dollar into, and profits go up every year. And they're better businesses to own. So while the share price of BHP is up 58% this year, it's actually down 44% over the last 8 years.
Hmm. Yes, well, that's true. I mean, BHP is like one of these blue chips. I mean, it's like Telstra, isn't it?
It's sort of gone nowhere for a very long time.
It's gone nowhere for a very long time.
Indeed. Yes. Mm. And so that's what
well,
happened.
Well, hang on. That's at least in its share price, although, you know, I mean, other investors would argue, yes, but it's paid reasonable dividends along the way too.
Well, if we include those dividends, you're still much better off in the sorts of businesses that are actually able to grow their profits without requiring any additional capital. Mm-hmm. They will increase the income Trump. So the CSLs of the world, the Cochleas of the world, you know, smaller companies like M2 Telecommunications, and there are many others. Reese is another one. ARB is another one. Businesses that without the benefit of additional capital have grown profits enormously. And they're the sort of businesses that you want to own. But last year, when we divide up the market in terms of deciles of quality, with the worst quality down one end of the spectrum and the very highest quality at the other end of the spectrum, what we found was that the highest quality businesses did the worst, and the lowest quality businesses, by our definition, admittedly, did the best. Mm. And we think that the best time to invest in quality is when it's being spurned by everybody else, which is the case at the moment. But we'll come to 2017. So that's the stock market. Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about property, because property prices went up again.
Against predictions. People thought, this bubble has to burst.
And I'm one of the most vocal.
You sat here and said, this is all going to finish.
And it will. And I haven't said it.
But it didn't.
Well, no, I can't give you the exact date, but I do believe over the next, and I said this last year, over the next 24 months it'll happen. So we've got another 12 months or 18 months to go. Let's talk about what actually happened in the property market, because it was pretty interesting. I'll give you some interesting facts just to begin with. The first one was that we discovered that the residential crane count in Australia skyrocketed by 313%, and in fact, in the September quarter, there were more residential construction cranes along the east coast of Australia than in New York, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Toronto, and Calgary combined.
That's an incredible fact.
That is an incredible little fact, and something that won't last for long.
The short answer is we know, don't we, that according to lending figures, that nearly 50% of the loans given out are to investors.
Well, that's
so
exactly right.
So they're investors. Investors are buying these things. It's not people to live in them. I mean, sorry, it's not home buyers. It's investors.
They're buying to gamble on the price going up.
Yep.
But in addition to that, there was a UBS survey that came out at the end of the year, and they said that more than a quarter of 1,228 Australian home buyers who had taken out a mortgage over the past 2 years admitted that they'd represented some information on their loan application. So the quality of those loans isn't very good. The ability of the people who are taking out loans towards the end of a property boom tends to be lower quality. And they tend to borrow more than they can afford. And so financial stress is a real risk over the next 18 months. So we've got that crane index, which is really interesting. I think that people just to keep that in mind. Then we've got property doyens that are actually selling. So Harry Triguboff tried to sell Meriton.
Did he succeed?
No, I don't believe he did. He tried to sell it to the Chinese. Mm. He didn't succeed, or maybe he didn't get the price that he wanted, so he's hanging on to it. I'll talk a little bit about the economics of that business later on. It's a brilliant business. The for sale shingle was placed on the Sol Pats building in Sydney's Pitt Street Mall, and that's a building that's been held by the Washington H. Sol Pats family and Rob Milner now for over 100 years, and they are incredibly good property investors. For them to be selling their flagship property, you know, that's an interesting takeaway. Mm-hmm. We also know that John Simon listed his waterfront mansion on Sydney Harbour for sale, and John Gandell realised something, you know, very large profit by selling his $500 million stake in Charter Hall. So I think he's only property investment now, or the major property investment that he's got now, is Chadstone down in Melbourne, or his stake in Chadstone. So there are a lot of very, very savvy property investors who have made some noise about getting out or have done some exiting.
Can I
which
ask
is
you
interesting.
This, you and I have had this conversation. I've had this conversation with others. Mm. There's not going to be a bust so much as property prices will just not go up anymore. Now, over time, of course, that represents a loss.
Well, let's talk about that.
But
talk about how. Let's look at what's actually going on. Mm-hmm. What we know is that there's been a very, very large number of properties sold for investment purposes and sold by property developers. Now, what we know is that some proportion of those properties, those apartments, let's just stick to apartments for the moment, because I think that's where ground zero is going to be. Mm-hmm. a proportion of those apartments were sold to foreign investors or foreign buyers. Now, what we know is that in December, foreign exchange outflows from China amounted to almost nil. So no money was allowed to come out of China. And that's partly a reflection of the fact that they've got a financial problem of their own.
Well,
amongst
they've got
the
new rules in place, haven't they? You can only take out $50,000
per year per person.
And you can't spend the $50,000 on real estate.
Yeah, so what that means is that many investors who had purchased, foreign investors who had purchased apartment off the plan, because remember you can only buy new, you can't buy existing, who purchased off the plan 2 years ago and managed to get their deposit out of China, thinking that they'd be able to get the rest of the money out of China to settle the transaction when the property was completed, weren't able to. Mm-hmm. And so, are unable to. So we don't know. I can't tell you what proportion that is, but it's some proportion of the amount that was sold. We also know that.
That'll be good news for developers, won't it? Because they can keep the deposits and sell the properties again.
If they can. So who would they then sell to? Local investors. But we also know there's a bunch of local investors who will find it hard to actually settle, partly because the banks have said either one, we're not willing to lend in that suburb now, and they've put out lists of entire suburbs that they're just not going to invest in. They've also brought down the loan to value ratio. So if you, let's say you borrowed $100,000 for $1 million apartment, the bank's now saying, we want you to have $200,000 deposit or a 20%. We want you to have a 20% deposit. So you have to have more. And upon settlement, the banks have also reduced their valuations, the market valuations. So that will, those, the combination of those things will spur some local investors to balk at settling. So the failure rate is picking up. We know, for example, that
What are you actually saying here, though? You're saying that in 2017, it's going to happen?
Well, no, I think it'll take a little bit longer than that.
But what is it? Because, this is what I'm trying to get to. What is the thing?
Developers discounting apartments in order to move the oversupply.
Can I put this to you? That house prices in Sydney and Melbourne increased by, what, 10, 15% last year?
Correct. It was about, I think it was about 12.
Yeah. In 2017, some say, house prices will only rise by 4%. In other words, there's not going to be a collapse.
No, that's
right.
There'll
just be a tapering.
But let me finish this
in the increase.
Let's look at this transmission mechanism and what I'm describing here. So you've got developers who are developing properties, completing properties now that a proportion of which won't settle.
Yep.
And Mirvac came out last year and said they had about 3% of their apartments that weren't settled. They were able to resell them. And that's going to be easier to do when you're not in oversupply. But the oversupply, the spike in oversupply is still to come. And if you have a look at Brisbane, for example, Brisbane in the 9 months to September last year, they had about 5,500 apartments completed within 5 kilometres of the CBD. At the same time, vacancies 5 to 15 kilometres from the CBD rose from 2.7% to 4.7%. So you had a near doubling of the vacancy rate. So that puts financial stress on people who've borrowed money to buy an apartment if they haven't got a tenant. Now, that's with 5,500 apartments being completed. In the next, we've got another 9 months to go to September this year, there's another 13,000 apartments due to be completed within 5 kilometres of the CBD. So presumably vacancy rates will go up even more further out, putting more financial strain on people who've borrowed money to buy those apartments, putting them under pressure to sell them, and that's in addition to the additional supply. So then you've got people who are desperate to sell or need to sell because of the financial stress that they're under, and that compounds the problem. Now, the developers still have borrowings to the bank, and they've been capitalising their borrowings. So they don't pay anything back. They don't even pay interest back while they're developing those properties. They capitalise the interest, and that's added on to the loan, and then that needs to be paid back to the banks. And if you're a developer and you're not moving those apartments, then you're under financial strain yourself.
You have to discount the apartments. I'm curious about this because we've been talking about this for several years now.
I started talking about it last year.
Not just you.
Yeah, I started talking about it last year because I could see it happening.
Roger Montgomery is my guest. He's the Chief Investment Officer of Montgomery Investment Management. We're talking about investment, particularly in a property, and what's going to happen in 2017. Your chance to have your say too. 1-300-800-222. There are some spots free. It's 25 past 10, 25 past 9 in Queensland, 25 past 7 in Western Australia. Warren's on the line. Hi, Warren.
Yeah, good evening, Phil and Roger.
G'day, Warren.
It's an interesting discussion of the property, and I just wanted to ask about your views on balanced superannuation funds for this year, given that the property is still part of that. But do you have a view on how that might be trending this year? I think last year was around 7%, I think.
Yeah, look, I think the issue will be making sure that in the balanced funds that you talk of, you're speaking about, the investment in fixed interest, so the bond part of the portfolio, it is only my view, but it's my view that you really want to see the duration of that part of the portfolio shortened. And what that means is that if interest rates go up and bond rates climb, then the capital loss on longer-term bonds tends to be much greater than on shorter-term bonds. And so by reducing the duration, you're reducing the period, if you like, or the average duration of the bonds in the portfolio, and that makes them less sensitive to increases in interest rates. So if interest rates were to surprise on the upside, and I don't mean central banks raising interest rates, I just mean market rates for bonds going up, then the portfolios, the balanced funds that have a very high weighting in long duration bonds are going to suffer the most.
Mm. And I guess to find out all this as an average investor, it's to know if it's in a pre-mixed fund.
Well, you can actually call the manager. The manager will most of the large managers will have a department that answers questions about their portfolio. And if the relatively junior people answering those calls can't answer those questions, they often will refer it to the fund manager and the fund manager will get back to you. There's not many questions that they can't answer. So the sort of topic we're discussing now is something that you would want the fund manager to actually answer for you. And it's not unusual for them to call you back. I've had to ask a few in my time and they've called back.
Yeah, I believe a fairly boring sort of indexed balance fund last year, I think, got to number one in terms of the return on investment. I understand some large funds now are investing in overseas shopping centres and freeways and railway stations in England and so on. Is that a new trend in superannuation?
No. What's happening is that the premium that's being offered by riskier assets is being compressed, and so because bond rates have been so low for so long and term deposit rates have been so low for so long, people have been forced to migrate up the risk spectrum and look for higher returns elsewhere. And so the sorts of asset classes that you're talking about is precisely where professional investors have moved their investors' funds to. But I worry that down the track we'll look back on this period aghast that our managers invested in such long duration assets for such low returns. Really, what they're doing is they're taking much greater risk but still accepting only bond-like returns. An example of that is junk bonds in the United States. This time last year, there was an 8 or 9% difference in the interest rate being offered between the US Treasury and the worst-rated junk bonds. And now that difference is only about 3.5 or 3.6%. So there's not much difference out there. And that usually doesn't coexist for long. You usually don't get that compression lasting for very long. And that means that asset prices at some point in the not too distant future are going to have to come off.
Yeah, I was just wondering, because it appears to me that the risk is going up to some extent, and I'm not really sure what that means. But
I can tell you exactly what it means. Most investors are accepting very low rates of return for very high rates or very high levels of volatility potentially. And while the volatility looks low because prices have just been going up and up and up amid this low interest rate environment, eventually they'll reverse.
Okay.
Thanks very much for that, and that's great advice. And but it's really a 10-year plus period for superannuation balance.
Always.
Yeah.
Irrespective of your age.
Yeah. Yeah. We're all going to live forever, Warren.
Exactly. You've got to behave as if you will. Anyway.
Thanks very much.
Okay, pleasure.
Thanks, Warren. Bye-bye. Yes. Mary's on the line from Cairns with a good question too. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, Mary.
Hi. Yes, I've got two questions, actually. One is just that if you're talking about if the property prices in Sydney with the oversupply of apartments, how that will affect property prices. Do you think that will trickle on to other parts of Australia as well, or do you think it'll just be confined to Sydney?
Because you're up in Cairns, aren't you, Mary?
That's right.
Yeah. lots of participants in the property industry believe that you can quarantine any sort of price fall. So when I talk to agents down in Melbourne, they'll say, yeah, look, Brisbane's got a problem, hasn't it? And when I talk to them in Brisbane, they'll say, yeah, Melbourne and Sydney have a problem. You know, it's never in my town. In the Financial Review, there's, you know, that we saw a preponderance this year of property, young under 30-year-old property developers in the BRW Young Rich List. You know, they've never seen a recession. They think prices only go up. And I note one was quoted as saying, yes, look, there is a problem in the property market, but it's really the developments where there are 200 apartments, not our sort of development where we're doing 30 to 60 apartments in a development, you know, please. So I can't tell you what the transmission mechanism will be that will cause Cairns to fall, and I can't tell you the extent of any fall in Cairns if it does, if we see prices fall in Brisbane, Melbourne and Sydney. But it's unlikely that it would be immune to any falls because there's a certain amount of migration that occurs within Australian states. And so if prices fell a lot in one city and not in another, people would say, you know what, I can move from Cairns to Sydney, or I can move from Brisbane to Melbourne. You know, prices have dropped 30% there, but they haven't dropped here. I'm going to go and buy myself an apartment down there and set up my life down there. And because of that migration, prices tend to catch on. You know, they tend to follow.
And Roger, yeah. You've also made an interesting point. Mary, this is an interesting point that Roger makes too. And that is, Roger, you've had a look at the number of real estate agents Australia. Now,
yeah, you'd think
that this really shouldn't vary that much, actually, should it?
No. Well, the population of Australia grows at about 1.6% per annum. The number of real estate agents servicing that population should grow by about 1.6% per annum. But over the last 3 years, it's grown by almost 9% per annum. And that's not a good sign.
That's a stunning figure, isn't it?
Yeah, that's not
that
a good sign.
That can't be a good sign.
I've seen it before where you get these proliferation of newly branded, freshly minted real estate agencies, you know, with brands you've never heard before. Hmm. And then they all disappear again when the property market slows down and sales stop. And that reminds me, in Canada, and particularly Vancouver, some of the wealthy suburbs in Vancouver, they also benefited from Chinese demand for their properties. But what's happened is they lumped a 15% tax on foreign purchases over there in, I think it was August last year. Since then, so in August 2016, this tax was imposed on foreign purchases of property in Canada. And then what's happened is in January, the percentage decline in sales was 40% compared to January 2016. Mm. So people really have a tough time selling now at the prices that they previously could have got.
Mm. Yep. All right. Thanks, Mary.
Can I just ask my second question?
Oh, yes, your second question.
Course,
go ahead.
Of course you can, Mary. Just before we do, 1-300-800-222, by the way, if people want to ring, there's some lines free. 1-300-800-222. Sorry, Mary. Yes, away you go.
That's okay. Just regarding the other previous caller who was talking about superannuation, I noticed that, you know, the government's brought in some new taxation system regarding superannuation if you've got so many.
$1.6 million. Yep. There's a cap.
Something like
yep.
that. So, you know, what kind of safeguards have we got in this country so that, you know, for instance, if the Australian government did suddenly feel like they were too poor, that they divvied into people's accounts. Like
that is a topic. I wrote an article about this for the Australian newspaper some years ago, and I looked at the history of legislative change as it applies to superannuation over time. And what I discovered was that all of the changes that were made, virtually all the changes that were made, grandfathered the baby boomers and so that the next generation, my generation, which is Generation X, copped it. So the title of the article was something like, Dear Under 40 Investor, Minimize Your Contribution to Super. And you're right, you know, one of the things I alluded to in the article was I think that as the pool of superannuation funds grows, the temptation to dip into it from a fiscally constrained government will be too great. And we might find that we have to work until we're 85 before we see it, or it gets taxed at much higher rates if we try and take it out. And we're already seeing all of those changes. The trend is towards that direction anyway.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
All right, Mary.
It's a good point.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for your questions.
Appreciate it, Mary. Thank you. John from Albury. Hello, John.
Good afternoon. Oh, evening.
Yes, evening.
Evening.
I'm just interested in the... as we're talking about iron ore exports, I'm not absolutely 100% sure, but is China one of our biggest purchasers?
They are the biggest. Absolutely the biggest.
The thing is, like I've heard, well, you hear rumours, you know, our dollar going to 50 cents and all that sort of business.
That's just talk. You can ignore that.
Yeah, that's true. But the thing that's going on, you know, with... China and all those sort of things, what Trump's up to and what he's putting demands on China for trade. And
well, yeah, the idea is that he puts a tariff on imports into the United States from China, so on Chinese exports, if you like,
yeah.
And that would then affect, the theory goes that would affect their economic growth, and that would put many businesses in China under strain, and they've already borrowed a record amount of money, and it's arguable that you know, there's a huge amount of borrowings in China that will never be paid back because they were bad loans made during the heyday when the Chinese government was building infrastructure and the like, which was the reason for all of the iron ore demand.
Yeah. If China goes, I know they've been stockpiling iron ore for quite a while.
Yeah, and they're at record highs again now, the Chinese iron ore stockpiles. That's correct.
Yeah, now, how linked is the iron ore to our dollar?
Well, our currency, our currency is seen as a commodity currency. So when commodity prices are looking like they're going up, then our currency tends to do relatively well. When commodity prices look like they're going down, it does relatively poorly. The thing with currency, though, and you know you've referred to it a couple of times in your question, is that there's only a few times in your life when it's really obviously expensive and really obviously cheap. The rest of the time, it's just noise. So when it was over $1.05, that was clearly ridiculous and that wasn't going to be sustained. When it was down at 49 cents or 57 cents, that's clearly cheap and that's not going to be sustained either. So at the extremes, it's really obvious and you'll know what's going to happen next. But in between, it's really, really difficult. It really is, you know, barbecue chit-chat. No one's going to get it right consistently.
Oh, yeah, you know how it is, you know, you hear different things, read different things and have different opinions. But you've got to look at them and analyse, see what you think.
Exactly right, John. All right, mate, we'll move on because others do want to have a say. Let's get down to Melbourne where I've got a couple of callers in the middle of what is an overheated apartment market, for sure.
Shane, interesting to hear their insights.
Shane, yes, good evening.
Yes, g'day, fellas. Good evening. Thank you for my call.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for your call.
I have, I guess, in a nutshell, a very basic question. My wife and I are looking at buying a house either middle of next year or the year after, so middle of 2018 or middle of 2019.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. We're renting at the moment. Living in Melbourne.
Hang on, Shane, can you just get back on the phone? You've just...
Oh, sorry, mate.
That's better.
Can you hear me now? Is that better?
Perfect. Better, much
yeah.
better.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, sorry. I guess in a nutshell, we're living in Melbourne's west, and houses have sort of gone up pretty high price-wise. My biggest fear and my wife's biggest fear is a friend of mine in 2007 paid through the nose for a very expensive house, and then 12 months later the GFC hit and he lost a fortune. So I guess, is it smarter for us to buy a house, do you think, knowing, on your opinion, the middle of next year or the middle of the year after?
Look, I'd love to be able to say buy it at 4 p.m. on April the 17th. You know, that would be ideal. Can we just go back to your mate who bought that place at the top of the market in 07 and then went through the GFC? I'm not sure the price they paid and how extreme that price was, but if they weren't forced to sell and they were still holding it today, I'd be very surprised if they would have lost money. So then the issue isn't when you buy. The issue is the circumstances under which you buy or how you finance that purchase. So if you're paying cash and you're going to hold the property for 30 years, it probably doesn't matter if you buy it next year or the year after.
It won't make high or low.
It's not going to make any difference at all. On, you know, you don't even care about that. What matters is you've got a roof over your head, you've got security, you've got a place to raise your kids, and that's what's important. The issue is for people who've borrowed money, and they've borrowed to the extent that if interest rates went up even a couple of percent, you know, they're really going to struggle to put food on the table. And then if they lose their job, you know, then they're forced to sell and they lose money and they have to declare bankruptcy. That's when things go really pear-shaped and that's when you have to be really careful. So it comes back to a question about how you're financing and how big a deposit you've got. The bigger your deposit, the less concerned you need to be. But you should also, when you're thinking about how much money you're going to borrow, if you are going to borrow money to buy, you need to think about, well, what if interest rates were double where they are today? Can I still afford to meet the mortgage? And are we still comfortable? And then that sets your budget for the sort of property you can actually buy. And it might be you just need to lower your expectations in terms of where you buy.
Yeah, well, we sort of wanted to hopefully stay in the same area, and we are using that thinking by saving as much as we can in the next 12 to 24 months. Obviously, with Melbourne's West, with the end of this year, there's going to be substantial job losses through to Toyota and
of course,
and so forth. So that's going to, I think, really affect house prices in Melbourne's West.
You know, this is where, when I was last on Phil last year, we talked about a strategy where, you know, if you see that happening and you can actually plant the seed with a few local real estate agents and say, look, you know, if someone comes to you and they're clearly, you know, under a bit of pressure, then, you know, give me a call. They're obviously going to call a few people because they want to get the best price they can. That's their job. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you want to know about those forced sales. And that's where, you know, that's where you may pick up a good deal.
Yeah.
Good luck with it, Shane.
Thanks for that, mate.
Okay, pleasure.
Good luck with it. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's what you're saying, sensible advice to idea that if you're buying a house to live in and raise your kids and so on, and you're going to hold it for a while.
There's just things that are more important than the rate of return.
Don't stress about it too much. Yeah. If you're in it for an investment and you're highly geared, you need
Then that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about people at risk.
That's what you're talking about. You're exactly right. Marshall, hello.
Good day, guys. How you going?
Well, thank you.
So I have a bit of a two-part question, if I might ask. I have an investment property that I purchased off the plan about 4 years ago in Hawthorn. And so we lived in there for about a year, and then we rented it out. In the same space of time, we then went and bought a second bigger apartment in Hawthorn again for about $650. Now, from hearing your conversation previously, it sounds like the market might not be doing too well. We were already thinking of selling the first one, so we'd, you know, have a bit of flexibility if worst comes to worst. What is your opinion on, say, selling the one apartment within the next couple of months? Do you think the prices might have a chance of going up in the next, say, couple of years?
That's impossible to know. But let me just say this. You can do very well financially over the long run, over your lifetime, if you're patient and you don't need to borrow a lot of money. If your gearing is so high that you can see stress down the track, then the answer to your question is really, really obvious. You know, reduce the stress. You may not make as much money, but you're not going to lose as much either. And you're not going to have the stress in your life, which you just don't need. So, look, borrowing is about getting somewhere faster than you could have got without borrowing. And so people who are in a rush borrow lots of money. But I don't think you need to be in a rush in life. I think you'll live longer than you realize and you'll do just fine without having to borrow a lot of money.
Okay. I guess the last part of my question is, we're a growing family, at some point we're thinking of actually then purchasing an actual house and selling the apartment. In your opinion, what do you reckon the performance of landed properties are as opposed to, say, apartments the next couple of years?
I've always believed that freestanding houses on land are less volatile than apartments. And I think over time, as the population of Australia increases and apartments become, I guess, more commonplace, the relative value of houses goes up.
Okay. And say, for instance, like right now, currently you find houses selling for $1 million point something. Do you think that value will continue to maintain? Is this something that will continue to be the case?
Look, earlier you heard Phil and I talking about the risk that apartment prices fall because developers are forced to discount properties in order to move them because they're going into oversupply. That's my thesis. That's my view. The extent to which that impacts house prices depends on a term called fungibility. So that's the willingness of buyers to transfer their desire for a house to an apartment. So what do I mean by that? In practical terms, it means to what extent, if apartment prices fall, will buyers at an auction for a house decide not to bid on the house, instead go for the apartment because it's fallen and the house hasn't? That the extent to which people are willing to do that transfer will ultimately determine the extent to which house prices go down or stop going up.
Okay, I got you.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marshall. Good on you. Bye. 1-300-800-222. If you would like to call, there are some lines free. Karen, I'll get to your call next. Jane from Canterbury has texted me saying, hi there, is the Sydney apartment bubble going to burst? Councils are still approving blocks of 400-plus apartments an hour in our area. The local newspaper said that investment from China in Sydney is cooling. What do you think? Well, I think you've answered that question.
Yeah, look,
and yet the short answer is that you think the bubble will burst.
High-rise residential apartments, we've never seen anything like it in Australia in terms of supply. And what we saw in October, for example, was that that approvals collapsed. They fell by about 40%, and that means 2 years down the track, that means construction will stop as well. But in the interim, we've got enormous increase in supply. We're building something like 230 or 240,000 apartments a year. This is just apartments, and household formation is increasing at the rate of about 150,000 a year.
That's got to give at some point.
Of course it does.
Yeah.
It has to have an effect on prices. You can't have record prices and record supply coexisting.
It's got to give. It just has to. Karen from North Mead, hello.
Hi, how are you going?
Well, thank you.
My husband and I recently bought an investment property in Melbourne. I'm using my in-laws as guarantors for our deposit because we're not able to save a deposit.
Mm-hmm.
And we bought a freestanding house off the plan, and we rent in Sydney. And we eventually would like to stop renting just because it's a little bit annoying.
Mm.
Given the oversupply of apartments, in the foreseeable future in Sydney, would it be a good time to buy an apartment as our primary place of residence?
Well, if the scenario that I envisage happening does happen, and there's no guarantee that I'm right, but let's assume that I am and that it happens, well, 15, 20%, 30% declines in some developments, and I'm not saying across the board, but in some individual developments that would happen. And so if that does happen, then the opportunity will be there for you. But then you're going to have to, presumably while you're in Sydney, you're saving money. I don't know is the property in Melbourne positively geared? Is the rent covering the mortgage?
Yes, it will. It puts about nearly $2,000 in our pocket every year.
Right. Okay. So it's just washing its face. Over the course of a year. Well, presumably you're also saving for a deposit on something in Sydney when the time comes to buy. Is that correct?
Well, currently we've kind of given up in Sydney and find ourselves in a position which many people, I guess, our age, young professionals with no children thinking of starting a family, found ourselves in. Jobs are here in Sydney, but none of us can really afford to buy a house here in Sydney.
Well, it's impossible now, isn't it, Karen? The median price is $1.2 million. Well, it's impossible.
Yeah. Can I, Karen, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Are you delaying having children because you haven't got a house?
Somewhat, yes.
Yeah, is that a conversation you've had? You know, we've got to have the house first before we have kids?
Well, I'm nearly 30.
Yeah.
So, and my husband's over 30, 33.
Yes.
And we've been married for 4 years. And
so you'd like to have kids soon, no doubt.
Yeah, we would. And we currently live in a two-bedroom apartment, and, like, that's okay for one child.
Yeah.
But if we go on to have another one,
yes,
I literally feel like we will have nowhere to go.
Yeah, yeah.
If things stay the same in terms of the price, the housing price. And, I mean, anecdotally, I speak to people, my friends, people in my outer circle who are similar situations with us, all making, you know, not average incomes, above average, and all not able to purchase where we work.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a dilemma that an entire generation of people have found themselves
in.
But
just been locked out.
But I also believe, but Phil and Karen, I don't believe you can have a generation of people who own property who are all getting much, much older. These are the baby boomers with the bulk of their assets tied in property. At some point in their lives, they will need to sell those properties because most of their money is tied up in their property. Who do they sell to? They sell to the generation below them who are all complaining that prices are too high. Prices have to meet in the middle. That's been my view for quite some time. So I think you just have to be patient, Karen. I'm sorry that you find yourself in that sort of generational demographic that is really finding it tough at the moment. But I think patience will be rewarded.
Okay. Thank you for that.
That's okay. It's just one person's opinion, though. Bear that in mind.
No, that's totally fine. And I think that's the reason why we ended up looking outside of Sydney and, with the help of a property investment specialist, chose the property we did in Melbourne and, you know, having to move a lot of little pieces, I guess, to make it happen just to get our foot in that door.
Yeah, but just make sure that, you know, you can meet the mortgage repayments if interest rates go up.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Karen. It makes me despair, really. I mean, it must make you too, in a way.
It is incredibly...
One generation has really locked... The subsequent generation out of home ownership.
But Phil, I come back to the stats. You know, up until the 1970s, property prices in Australia rose with inflation.
Yeah.
You know, that's it. Between 1970 and more recent, you know, say 2000, they rose with salaries. And that was because of the baby boomers, right?
Hmm.
And then from 2000 onwards, they've really risen just beyond even income growth. So... Hmm. Look, it's just not, I just can't see it sustaining itself. There will be a catalyst. I believe the catalyst is the scenario that I enunciated, which is this idea that property developers will be forced to discount. We're already seeing it. In Melbourne, Brisbane and Sydney, I've seen property developers offering 10-year rental guarantees, which are worthless, by the way. I've seen property developers offering a million frequent flyer points, and I've seen them offer, if you buy an apartment from them, and I've seen them offering holidays to Bali and Thailand, for example, if you buy. So this is the beginning of the discount cycle. These are developers starting to discount.
Yeah, and I know you made these points before, Roger. They're powerful points. They're worth repeating, aren't they? That it's all very well to say that apartments are there, but people, and Karen, we just spoke to one. You know, we just spoke to a young Australian who's looking to start a family, and they need more space than this. They want a house. Like they're not going to be in the apartment market.
No.
Household formation is about also families.
Look,
those families, you know,
what I know with every market is it transfers. Doesn't matter whether it's the property market or the stock market, and this is, you know, from a couple of decades now of experience. But what I see it always doing is it transfers wealth from people who have no patience to people who do. So irrespective of whatever market you're investing in, you've got to be patient and wait for those bargains to come around. And they will. There'll be individual developers who are under stress, who can't sell their apartments. You've got to be on the lookout. You've got to make sure that you're on top of it, though, because they may not hang around for long. But there will be developers under stress who'll need to sell at a discount, and people will be able to pick up a few bargains.
1-300-800-222 is the number. There are some spots free. Matt's on the line from Perth. Hello, Matt.
Good evening, gentlemen.
G'day, Matt.
Yeah, look, my question relates to, I've just recently set up a self-managed super fund because I wanted to directly invest in US equities. And my first question relates to, one thing I don't understand fully is, I understand that you don't have direct ownership of those shares. And just wondering what the risk is involved with that. I'm looking at using, I think it's CBA's international trading platform.
Yeah, so there are alternatives where you do have the direct ownership of the shares, and my suggestion is that you simply Google those alternatives rather than me promoting them on air. But there are offers available where you can transact online, and you will have direct ownership of those shares.
Yes, because one of the concerns I have, because I'm looking at purchasing and holding, I'm in my early 40s, I'm looking at purchasing and holding for long-term growth.
Yeah,
so
sure.
So sort of 10 plus years.
Yep.
And, obviously the security of ownership is one issue that does worry me in the longer term.
You know, I think it's right, you know, it's right to, because what you're actually talking about is something called counterparty risk. And it's right to be thinking about those issues. It tells me that you're looking at all, you're asking all the right questions. You just need to do a little bit more digging and you'll get the answer.
Okay.
All right.
And look, the second part of that just relates to, I don't know what my future holds, because my wife is European, and around retirement age, I could either be in Australia or in Europe.
Sure.
Or potentially elsewhere.
That sounds exciting. So,
yeah, look, and so by investing in US shares and US dollars, we thought that might be a help out with a bit of a currency hedge, I guess, almost.
Yep. I'm not much older than you, and when the Aussie dollar was at, when the Aussie dollar was at 102, 103, I put a substantial amount of my cash holdings into US dollars and Singapore dollars for exactly the same reason, that I wanted to preserve my international purchasing power. And that's exactly what you're talking about. And that makes sense. It's just harder to get it right when the Aussie's at 76 cents than when it's at $1.02.
Yes. Yeah.
All right.
Very much.
Thanks, Matt.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good on you. Bye-bye. Well, I think we've got time for one more quick one.
Okay.
David from Innisfail. Hello, David.
Good evening. Thanks for answering my questions.
No problem.
I was just wondering, if the property, the apartment market does make a correction as you expected, what do you think will happen after that occurs?
Yeah, okay. It's an excellent question. I wrote it's a question I don't get asked very often, but it's the most important question. Does it then track along the bottom for a long time? Does it, does it bounce immediately? I think there's going to be, I wrote a blog post about this. I think what will actually happen is it'll coincide with a period of deleveraging. And what deleveraging means is people don't consume as much. They don't spend as much. There's not as much growth in the economy. And as a result of that, that is a function of the fact that they basically batten down the hatches and start paying off debt. And that has the simultaneous effect of preventing assets from reflating very quickly. So it's likely there's a longer period where prices don't do very much.
Okay. Oh, well, thanks very much.
Okay,
good
no
on you,
problem.
David. Yeah. Good on you, David. Yeah. Yes, it's as you say. Look, in the end, the numbers can't lie, can they?
No.
In relation to what's going on in the apartment market in particular. In the end, the numbers cannot lie. Keep going up and up and up.
And Phil, whenever you get a market where everyone thinks they're going to be rich, you know there's a problem. And that's what we've seen in apartments.
What's that old one about when the elevator driver is getting into the market? That's the time.
Yeah, correct.
You should be well out of it.
Yeah, that's a lot of people listening probably didn't even realise there used to be drivers of elevators.
There were. Yes, good stuff. All right, Roger. It is sobering thinking, but as you say, there are some pretty sobering choices to be for young Australians too at the moment in the market.
Indeed.
In the housing market.
Indeed.
But time does If it doesn't cure everything, it does cure a lot of things,
doesn't it? It will.
Hmm. Thanks for that, Roger.
It's a pleasure.
Always,
nice to be
always
back.
Always informative. Roger Montgomery, Chief Investment Officer of Montgomery Investment Management. Thanks for the calls, too. You're on Nightlife with Philip Clark. Coming up, the news at 11. It's 10 in Queensland, of course, at 8 o'clock in Western Australia. After the news, science with Mary McKinnon. We'll have all the latest Hollywood gossip, too, with Catherine Tulich. And, of course, a little later, just exactly what is going on with this revisionist thinking about Russia. I'd like your views about that. Time now for the news.